Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. We welcome to the studios of CBS Interactive outgoing Sydney Morning Herald marketing editor Julian Lee.
Hello, Tim.
And Mumbrella deputy editor Robin Hicks.
Hello, Tim.
This week,
on Australian ads and controversial Queensland advertising,
Top Gear falls victim to dementia as the first ratings period of the year draws to a close.
Fuckwits and recovering arseholes in 7 and 10's legal battle.
Australia, New Zealand, the world's toughest backyard. So, Julian, welcome to the podcast. Your new role, deputy editor of the National Times, just been announced. We'll talk more about that in a moment. Now, you've been writing about the world of media and marketing in Australia for, I guess, about the last 6 years or so. What kind of changes have you seen in that time? What have been the things you've noticed?
Well, clearly the shift to digital is one that has just been massive. And I think when I first started in the job, we were kind of mildly excited by the idea of writing about an ad, and it would be a new television campaign. TV would very much be the lead medium. But nowadays, I rarely find myself writing about a television ad, and the whole area of what I write about now has just broken up and fragmented, much like the media, into so many different areas. It has become definitely more complex, really, as an area to cover than when I first began writing about marketing, which is actually probably about a decade ago.
Now, many journalists who've written about media marketing find themselves at some point ending up at agency side instead. You know, we've seen several of those even in recent weeks. You're sticking with journalism. Have you ever been tempted to move over to that darker side of communications, away from the purity of journalism?
I've considered it, because sometimes you get asked for your opinion, especially, you know, when you've just interviewed someone and they kind of like they show you their new shiny ad, and at the end of the conversation, which is when they think is kind of off the record, they say, "So, what do you think?" And more often than not, you think, "Well, what do I think? I think you should get your money back." A lot of the time, you feel that they've been slightly duped, or maybe that the way in which they're trying to communicate what they're doing could be done better. And sure, I've been tempted by that from time to time, but I don't think I'd be very good at it, actually, because I don't think I'd really be able to keep my counsel. And I think in that game, keeping your counsel and being a diplomat is absolutely essential.
Now, for me, that's why I could never stop being a journalist. I couldn't become a PR, for instance, because PRs have to be nice to journalists who don't deserve it, people like me.
Well, exactly. It'd be very, very difficult, Tim, to be nice to you.
It would indeed, yes. But, you know, let's maybe talk about your new role to start off with then. What makes you want to sort of move into the, I guess, the comment sphere?
Well, I think it's a growing area. We've seen that with the National Times, which lives within the Fairfax Digital Network, and also with The Punch and with Crikey and The Drum. And it's just a good showcase for good writing, both from within the building and from within our stable of writers, and as well as our outside contributors, but also from outside. You know, I'd like to try and get as many contributors as possible, probably from the media, advertising and marketing field. It's an area that I know, but I also think it's an area that is a very rich seam to mine for interesting commentary around, you know, how we Australians live our lives.
And will you have an opportunity to write as well?
Tim, I've got no idea what my workload is going to be. I literally start on Monday. I would really hope to be able to continue to write. I mean, it's clearly when a story comes my way and it's too good to pass on or pass up, I'll be writing it.
Mm. Can I just ask, Julian, who do you rate as the sort of preeminent best observer of marketing news at the moment in Australia?
Apart from myself, Robin.
Obviously, yeah.
And apart from Tim.
Yeah, apart from you guys.
Well, that's about it, really. No, I mean, I think everyone's got their strengths. Everyone tries to, you know, plough their own furrow. I think it's really hard for me to say, Robin. All I do know is that this is an incredibly well-reported round. And I think both all of us who originally hail from the UK would have probably been surprised by when we arrived here by the level of coverage that marketing, media and advertising is given, not only in trade media, but also in the mainstream newspapers with all the different sections. Mm. Some people would say it's over-reported and that there isn't enough of interest about the industry every week. I would probably not. I would argue against that because I think there's plenty of stuff you just have to fossick around a bit.
Yeah.
But it is an incredibly well-reported round.
It's extremely competitive, extremely so.
Yeah.
There are overlapping stories, inevitably, in the national media and also the trade titles. What do you think gives a trade or a national journalist writing about marketing the edge?
I think it's just a question of getting out as much as possible and listening to people. I think marketers really like to feel that someone is listening to what they are going through, the dilemmas that they face, the budgetary constraints that they face, and how they are coping with it. I think if you've just got a very good listening ear as a marketing journalist and really try to listen to them as much as possible, then I think you're going to try and keep ahead of the pace. But I think it must be one of the hardest rounds because it moves at a lightning speed. And as I said earlier on in the conversation, this whole area has fragmented to the degree that you're no longer picking up the phone to the CEO of an advertising agency, as I did, you know, when I first started out, and saying, so what's happening this week? You are on the phone to many, many different providers who are out there who are all part of the particular food chain that is marketing.
An ability to cut through a lot of bluster is also an ability to, I guess it comes naturally, to see through a lot of spin.
Yeah, there is a lot of spin, and unfortunately I think I've seen there's an increase in the amount of spin, there's an increase in the amount of minders. I wrote in a column last week, I slightly bemoaned the fact that we are now, we journalists who are covering the round, are now distant, placed at a greater distance from the marketing directors, and that marketing directors really don't engage in a debate about their particular industry because they are so over-managed by the media minders. And I think that's a shame because I think people want to see the voice of the marketer in the media. The marketer might argue, well, we get burnt all too often. Well, I'm sorry, you know, I think you just got to get into it and try and play a role as a thought leader.
It was interesting, the piece you wrote, which I totally agreed with, just that argument that there aren't that many big personality marketers anymore. You know, there are you could probably reel off five names, but then the next five might be a bit harder.
Well, it's more the brands that they represent seem to have really become, the real personalities themselves, the companies. I don't think we really have those kind of leading personalities in the field, and I think we're the poorer for it.
So who, in the time you've been doing this, who have you most enjoyed dealing with? Who are the people who have just been a pleasure to deal with, whether because they've given you great stories, they've just been interesting people?
Well, I don't think I'll name names, but I think I've always found the alcohol sector to be just great to deal with because they're just great thinkers and they are the ultimate marketers, really, because they're selling a fairly commoditized product, which really isn't that different from the other brown liquid that is in the other bottle. And they are selling you the badge, the lifestyle, the branding. And I think they're just very, very clever people. I've always found them to be among the few people who are engaging in that debate about, you know, with their marketing and with their advertising.
I suppose, yeah, it is still one of the few big moments when there's a new Carlton Draft ad or VB ad, for instance, that, you know, I can't think of many other ads that have that kind of anticipation now.
Not really, no. I mean, it doesn't seem to be the celebratory event that it used to be. I mean, the Coca-Cola advertising used to be something that every summer, that marked the beginning of the summer, and it was almost an event in itself. Now, I can't really tell you what was the last thing that was memorable that Coca-Cola did.
Do you come away from writing about this industry with a greater respect for the people within it than you went in?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's some incredibly smart people. I think they're sometimes constrained by what they say. There are a lot of very smart people, very creative people, and there's a lot of very charming people as well. I've really enjoyed dealing with a lot of people out there who have, sometimes I've had to find myself in the ring with them, and sometimes it's been uncomfortable for them and it's been uncomfortable for me, but I think that's part of the challenge and that's part of the cut and thrust of the marketing industry. I think I do have a very healthy respect for them, though I do say that there is quite a lot of blaggers and bullshit artists in the marketing industry, and I think they are incredibly good at convincing you when they walk through the door that they actually know something about something. And all too often that really falls apart by the end of a half an hour interview. You really do believe that there's just a lot of bluster there.
Do you think they sometimes actually don't realise it themselves, though?
No, because I think they just believe their own hype. And they've also got lots of lackeys and yes men, and including people in the agencies who kind of hold these people up, pay them a huge salary, give them a VP title, and just say, isn't this a fantastic person? We are so pleased to hire this person, and 4 months they're out the door, you know.
Well, next, speaking of out the door, is the grass always greener? On Australian ads and controversial Queensland advertising.
This week, the Australian Hotels Association and Clubs Australia released this fairly appalling ad that claims it's un-Australian to introduce a licence to punt. Let's have a listen.
Well, that was an eventful day. How about a quiet beer and a quick flutter down the pokies to unwind?
Lead the way, Brucey.
This licence to play the pokies the feds are talking about, that's a bit of a worry.
What?
You can't even put $10 in the pokies without getting a licence. And the government will be tracking what you win or lose.
Hey, the polly's watching what I bet on, like I'm some sort of criminal.
There's also the website itsunaustralian.com.au, pushing their agenda. But they're not the first industry group to use the 30-second spot to try and get the average Aussie on their side. First, the mining tax tried it with an equally atrocious ad. Then it was plain packaging for cigarettes.
When did government put up tobacco tax?
My customers didn't stop buying cigarettes.
But I lost sales on bread,
milk and magazines.
The government's latest idea is plain packaging for cigarettes.
So, guys, do you think it's a coincidence that all of these ads are so poor? I mean, I would imagine that creative agencies struggled with a brief that's difficult. I mean, what do you make of it?
Do you know what? I will come just a tiny bit to the defence of the agency behind the Un-Australia one, which is Banjo, just on the grounds that they've done some good ads and are an otherwise solid agency. I agree, I really dislike the ad. Funny enough, the first person who flagged it up to me, you know, I think the subject heading was patriotism, the last refuge of the scoundrel, which, you know, it's very much, it seems like a relatively lazy argument to make, is if you don't like something, just call it un-Australian and, you know, that's kryptonite that nobody else can touch. And I think that argument is getting so weak now that the strategy is beginning to show.
Well, I think when something is overused, it's in itself devalued. And I think it's being used so often now that I think it's kind of lost its meaning. And I also think that anyone who tries to fly the flag in marketing runs the risk of incurring the displeasure of the Australian public, who I don't think really like to see their flag being bandied around left, right and centre. I think we've moved on from beyond that, and I think it's a rather in poor taste.
Did you feel that the mining tax ads, the you know, prior to Rudd going, I felt they were a bit effective though. I mean, clearly they were,
and they were actually they were better ads. And I think the tobacco one, which you wrote about yesterday, was one that, you know, one person made the very very salient point that why should, if they aren't going to work, then why should we be scared of them? Actually, I don't mind this pokies ad because, you know, it's not really aimed at me. And I think all too often we stand in judgment about ads or communication that is not really aimed at us. It is aimed at other people who are using pokies. It's very amateurish. It's very cheesy and corny. And I love the
lead
line,
the way,
lead
Brucey.
The way, Brucey. I think is fantastic. But, you know, I don't mind it. It's probably going to do the job.
The ads I felt were pretty poor, but do you think there's anything Banjo could have done differently with the brief that they were given? Or do you think there's another way to bring to life, which is pretty much a thankless task?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, Banjo, they very much are about being a kind of ochre agency, so you can see why they would come to Banjo. You know, they're an Australian agency through and through.
And they're backed by John Singleton.
Exactly, yes. And it's very much in his, you know, I'm not aware that he would have had a direct involvement in this because I think he's more of an investment than a sort of day-to-day player in it. But, you know, that's the tone they were looking for. So I guess Banjo gave the client what the client wanted.
Yeah, and the comment stream was very interesting, I thought, and it did sort of go on towards freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And I expect that you can defend Banjo and the fact that it's given a government brief and therefore it should execute it in the best way it can. But yeah, I did have a problem with the ads, but yeah, I do go with the freedom of expression argument. Staying for the moment with new ad campaigns, also this week, Queensland Tourism has released a new campaign. Let's have a listen.
For years, people have been holidaying in Queensland because they think the grass is greener.
Well, this year, thanks to the floods, it really is.
The garden's looking pretty good.
Tim, do you think it's a little insensitive so soon after the floods?
I almost expected to start singing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life after trying to make the argument, well, yes, on the plus side. I think where I first became of the ad actually wasn't when it first broke. I happened to see Paul Murray talking about it on Sky News, making the point that, you know, people aren't fertiliser. You know, this is all kind of being pretty casual, but I suppose it's part of a wider campaign of a few ads trying to say, hey, you know, we're being tough, we're laughing in the face of adversity. Personally, I wouldn't have run that particular one.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, you mentioned that there were five commercials produced all by DDB Sydney, and all of them, I think pretty much all of them, or four out of five, make direct reference to the floods, which I thought was very interesting in tourism campaign. I mean, for example, in Japan, do you think post-Japan, where they're trying to pick up the pieces, will they make reference in a tourism campaign to what's happened? Probably not. And I just think that perhaps is it sort of Australian to be upfront and honest about what's happened? And yeah, we know what's happened, let's move on.
I think it would have been folly to not mention it. It was such an international news story. I mean, I had the amount of people who were contacting me in Sydney saying, are you all right? Showed that it was a story that resonated wide, far and wide, and it was on the BBC News a lot. I think for them to not mention it would have just looked a bit ridiculous and a bit like an oversight. And actually, I don't mind them. I think they have got an upbeat feel to them. They chime with Anna Bligh's message that you can't keep a good Queenslander down. So they're kind of on message, and they are in keeping with probably the sentiments that most Queenslanders would feel, which is, you know what, we're not going to let this beat us.
And it's not as if they weren't rigorously pre-tested before they went on air. I spoke to the marketing director, Steve McRoberts. He said that they were done in consultation with a variety of tourism bodies, plus the public, and who helped them come up with that line. So next, Top Gear falls victim to dementia.
With more than 94.5 million active users globally, eBay is the world's largest online marketplace. To make the most of your advertising dollar, visit advertise.ebay.com.au. This week, Channel 9's Top Gear hit a record ratings low of just 485,000 viewers. Now, it was a repeat, but it was in prime time and during a ratings week. Maybe to make matters worse, it was actually beaten by a documentary about dementia on the ABC. Now, that's not to say there's anything wrong with having a documentary about dementia. I gather from people who talked about it, it was a very good documentary. But symbolically, the idea that something quite worthy would beat something quite populist certainly suggests that that there might be some kind of issue there for Top Gear. Are you a fan of motoring shows, Julian?
Not really, no. Not at all. And I think the Top Gear format is perhaps tiring. And I think the viewers are definitely tired of being served up repeats. And you can just see that from the comments from people who are sort of saying, well, I can get the latest episodes from BitTorrent. I think the Top Gear episode is probably just part of the story about what's happening with Channel 9. Mm. They have had a very, very difficult start to the ratings season. And I can't really see that improving that much.
No, I mean, for instance, Wednesday night of this week, just looking at Nine's schedule, and they you know, obviously were running up the white flag to a certain extent because of My Kitchen Rules final being on. But it was episode of Mike and Molly, two episodes of Two and a Half Men, two episodes of Big Bang Theory, and that was Nine's whole Wednesday night, which kind of implies that they're short of programming, which will rate. So that's probably, you know, half of the problem, perhaps. Now, Still with TV, the first ratings period of 2011 comes to a close on Saturday night. Obvious winners and losers. Winners include Winners and Losers on 7. My Kitchen Rules for 7, which came in on Thursday night with just over 2 million for the season finale. The Farmer Wants a Wife has done okay for 9. That sort of bobbled around the million mark. And 10 hasn't yet brought much to the table, obviously, with MasterChef not launching until May the 1st. Let me maybe throw to to you, Robert. What do you see any little green shoots coming through for 9, for 10?
Yeah, I mean, I think the second half of the year will be very interesting post-Easter. And I've had a look at the... I'm no expert. I haven't seen all of the shows that are coming up. I've seen a few of the previews. And it does look like a very open race for the second half of the year. And indeed, I think there's one of the networks that said it would be narcissistic for... to 7 to presume that the race is over for the whole year, as one commentator did actually suggest that by March the whole ratings year had been won by 7 already, which I think is obviously premature.
Are you willing to call it, Julian? Is the race over for this year?
No, I don't think so, as much as 7 would like to say it is, and we are daily reminded that 7 is number one.
Yes, we get a lot of emails to that effect.
It comes out of the propaganda machine that is 7 at the moment, and there is more than an air of triumphalism at the moment. But
will you miss Simon Francis, 7 spokesman?
I will miss his energy and his drive and his enthusiasm for pushing Channel 7.
Yeah, he's. I admit his writing style, even when he doesn't like what I've written. The tone of the emails is so entertainingly written. I kind of actually look forward to the bollockings, to be honest.
Well, he certainly works hard for his pay packet. Yeah, I give that to Simon.
I think it might be a bit like Martin Sorrell, though. I think there might be 3 of them, really.
He could be cloned, yes.
There must be a huge team that he has. I mean, to churn out that many press releases, I mean, it's almost up to 5 a day on occasions about new programme launches, ratings, etc., and plus the digest. I wonder how big his team is.
Obviously the research team and stuff. In terms of the coming programming for the coming year, is there anything that sort of catches your eye?
No.
Not excited by the renovators, for instance.
Not really, no.
See, I am. I'm quite intrigued to see how that goes.
Well, I'll be interesting to see how well it does compare to the block.
Yes,
from a competitive.
Yeah, massive. Like the word from the set is that it's a massive production. That's like 110 production staff.
They've spent a fortune on it, so I'd like to think they'd get their investment back.
Well, next. Fuckwits and recovering assholes.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all these stories, go to mumbrella.com.au. Channel 7's legal case against James Warburton's Move to 10 has provided the media with hours of entertainment. This week he got our hands on James Warburton's affidavit, which reveals the fascinating inner workings of 7 and boss David Leckie. According to Warburton, Leckie believes all media buyers are fuckwits. Warburton himself is no stranger, of course, to slanging matches. In fact, the biggest media buyer of them all, Harold Mitchell, had some words for Warburton.
James Warburton, you once described him as an arsehole.
Well, what happened there was I denied for probably 5 years I'd even said that, because my wife said, "What on earth you say that for?" And I took the coward's way out. I said, "No, I've been misquoted." That's been done before, of course. But as we well know, and James and I get on famously about it all, and later I assess that really what he is a recovering arsehole.
So, Tim, Julian, interesting times ahead for both 7 and 10. How do you think Warburton's move will affect the big two networks? And will the insults continue to fly?
Yeah, I love the fact that all of the best insults always involve James Warburton in some way. Either he's giving them out, or he's in the room when they're being given out, or they're thrown at him. Because of course, he was also the one who described the pitch doctors as bottom feeders as well. So, and I also think that again in Warburton's affidavit was the comment from David Leckie, "Here comes Mr. Ambitious." And I've just got a feeling that Mr. Ambitious is a phrase that will stick for years to come, I suspect.
Yeah, David Leckie's got a colourful turn of phrase, that's for sure. But I don't think his comments about media buyers will be that much of news to the media buyers themselves. He's a man by who, by all accounts, speaks his mind quite plainly and openly to people. So the fact that he called them fuckwits in that particular affidavit, it probably won't be that much news to them.
Yeah, I talked to one agency boss the sort of following morning after that broke, and he just thought the whole thing was hilarious. Well, he was saying actually some junior members of the agency were sort of flapping around a bit But I think anyone who's had something to do with Leckie kind of knows that, yeah, that's kind of just how he is. He's this sort of volcanic force.
Well, Burton's response to Leckie when he said that was, well, hang on, these guys are our clients. Why would you say such a thing? Which I thought was this. But yeah. Also his description of Warburton himself, and we met a couple last night at the MasterChef party. We met some people that know James well, and they think very highly of him. So I wonder what his description of how much we should trust Leckie's opinion of Warburton.
Well, I don't know. I mean, he was obviously sorry to lose him, wasn't he? Because he felt threatened by him, but threatened with good reason, which was that, you know, Warburton was his natural successor. And that, I suppose, is the big question that comes out of this. Now, the tone that comes through from a few of the affidavits, including James Warburton, so it's obviously only one side of it, is it feels like a chapter's closing with David Leckie. He's nearly ready to go.
I think you're spot on, Tim. I think there's a real sort of end of an epoch about this. And I think, we've seen the changes in the media buying industry, who they have really smartened up their act. They've added so many different additions to their offering. And they are, you know, some of the leading thinkers now. And I think, you know, when you see comments like that and that kind of behaviour by people like David Leckie, it strikes me that perhaps there are still some within the TV networks that are hanging on to the old days when they would go into negotiations with a pair of boxing gloves and a healthy glass of whiskey beforehand.
The big question now is, with Warburton gone, who is the natural successor? You know, some would point towards Tim Warner from the programming side of things. Kurt Burnett is the heading up sales now, but obviously was, you know, one rung down. In a year's time, who do you think will be running Seven?
It's a very good question. I think that's something that they've been forced to consider now that their natural successor, James Warburton, is leaving the network. As to where James will go and when he can go is another matter.
Also, any hints as to what Warburton will do when he gets there? Presumably he'll start plundering his old company and take a few staff with him. Do you think that will happen?
I think that's inevitable, and there's already been quite a lot of speculation about some of the key executives he'd like to take with him, especially if he tries to do what he did with Seven Media Group and the cross-selling unit SMG Red, which he'd like to do with 10. Unfortunately, 10 doesn't really have the same assets to play with as 7.
A bit of outdoor, a bit of online.
Yeah, they can cobble it together, but I'm sure that if anyone can sell a proposition like that, even if it's enhanced by doing deals with others, it would probably be James.
And the other obvious alliance then, because of the joint ownership with Lachlan Murdoch, would be DMG on the radio side of things, you know, which are... They're already rather conveniently, practically neighbours in where they're, you know, where they're
located,
where they're headquartered. Absolutely.
Next, Australia, New Zealand, the world's toughest backyard.
To advertise with one of the top 10 most loved brands in Australia, visit advertise.ebay.com.au. The brand identity for the 2015 Cricket World Cup has been created, along with a video that positions co-hosts Australia and New Zealand as the world's toughest backyard, comparing the mountains of New Zealand to the outback of Australia. Robin, let's start with the logo. Do you like it?
Yeah, I did. I really do like it. It's sort of strong, sinewy, and I really like, obviously, when it's in motion on a TV screen. I think it looks really good, yeah.
Yeah, normally it's almost like a tradition, isn't it? A logo comes out, and I think of the London 2012 Olympics logo in particular. And the natural thing is to hate it. This actually was kind of all right, wasn't it?
Yeah, I love the colours, and I think it'll work really well visually. And as Robin said, when it comes to life, I wasn't too sure. There's a sort of bit that's hanging out to the left of the logo. I can see his bat, I can see his pads, I can see his head, and then there's this sort of bit that's sort of sticking out on the side, and I can't quite make out what that is.
No, I can't offer you a theory on that one. What we will do when we put the podcast up on the website is we'll include the logo as well, so that people can form their own views on that one.
Yeah. Also, the comments, also the story itself mentioned that what's to follow. There's going to be inclusions of Indigenous cultures in the ads. It's pointed out in the comments stream. I don't agree with this, but, you know, what's the relevance of using Indigenous cultures in communications about teams that don't feature any Indigenous players. For me, that's I think that's wrong.
Indigenous. Who the agency was it? Was it Interbrand?
It was Future Brand.
Future Brand.
Yes, yeah.
So but the thing is...
They've both got branding problems there, haven't they?
I don't necessarily associate cricket with Indigenous culture, or maybe I should, and maybe this could do a job of doing so, but it is not a connection I really make, nor is the toughest backyard a connection that I would make with cricket, which it is quite physical. You have to run back and forth, and you have to run up, and you have to bowl, but it is not the bone-crunching arena of a rugby league nor rugby union.
But also, I'd agree. And also, it's rare that a host of a Cricket World Cup actually wins the World Cup. India was a rare example. So it's a bit of a misnomer.
I suppose the other question, again, this was raised in the comment that I sort of found myself nodding along, is backyard is quite an Australian phrase as well. You know, it's not one you'd hear bandied around in, say, in England, for instance.
The garden.
Yeah, the garden, yes, which I'm not sure would work it. I don't know what the phrase would be that would work globally, but as a global ad, that line maybe feels like perhaps it was written by an Australian copywriter.
Yeah, but the imagery and I think using Indigenous cultures, I think it's irrelevant that there are no Indigenous players in the team. I think that obviously it's a symbol of the countries. I think the music, the imagery will actually work quite well.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much, the Sydney Morning Herald's Julian Lee.
Thanks, Tim.
And to my co-host Robin Hicks.
Cheers, Tim.
And CBS Interactive for use of their studios. Production was by Brooke Hemphill. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle-pip.